Welcome back to the IWA's podcast series, Wales A Work In Progress, which seeks to examine and inform the ongoing debate around Wales's constitutional and democratic future. The IWA's Constitutional Futures Project is supported by the Legal Education Foundation, and I'm Joe Rossiter. I'm co-director at the Institute of Welsh Affairs. Today, we are going to be discussing federalism and confederalism, picking up from a prior conversation we've had on this podcast with our guests today, who have just released a new booklet, which we will come on to, the Federal Confederal Letters. So we're going to discuss this booklet, some of the ideas contained within it, and bring it into a wider context. Before we get into the details, I'd like to introduce you to the booklet's co-authors. We've got Glyndwr Kenneth-Jones, is a writer on constitutional matters. He's an advocate for a UK-wide constitutional convention. He's a fellow of the IWA and regularly contributes articles and think pieces on Wales's constitutional future. And joining Glyndwr is David Melding. David Melding was Conservative MS for South Wales Central from 1999 to 2021, acting as Deputy Presiding Officer from 2011 to 2016. He's acknowledged authority on constitutional reform and is the author of Will Britain Survive Beyond 2020? And The Reform Union, the UK as a Federation. He's also a member of the Federal Trusts Council. And the letters, the Federal Confederal Letters, explore issues of constitutional history and development both in the UK and internationally, making the case for much needed reform of the UK's governing framework through sharing views and experiences on models of devolution federalism and confederalism. So do you want to start by giving us a summary of the letters? What made you embark on this project and why really you thought a letter format as well was the way to discuss in depth some of these constitutional issues that you go through? Shall I start with you, Glyndwr?
Yes, well, David and I have sort of known of each other for some time. We knew of our writings. We also knew of our preferences in terms of federalism, in David's case, and mine, confederalism, or a close form of confederalism, from my particular view. We engaged in a federal trust conference, I believe, back in 2022, David, at Westminster, where the discussion was formatted across England, Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland. David and I conducted the Wales debate. And in that conversation, contrasting the two models, we found not just the audience being interested, but ourselves being interested in learning a bit more about how did we get to our particular solutions, whilst acknowledging problems. David, does that sound about right?
Yeah, as Glyndwr said, we were both participants in a federal trust conference, which is very interesting, and looking at some fairly deep constitutional issues and issues of sovereignty. And I can't remember when we first discussed the possibility of exchanging letters, but I suppose the email has saved letter writing, hasn't it? It's returned to our culture, whereas perhaps 50 years ago it had almost died out. So to celebrate the fact that people write letters as emails again, and that one should aim at having fairly succinct arguments and discussions about quite precise aspects of the debate, and then go to and fro and develop and just see where you go, because that's the wonderful thing about letters, is its ability to respond and to present something in a way that you can just sort of take on board without having to read chapters and chapters.
Yeah, and I think you really get that to and fro between both of you on the letters, digging into different issues, but also because they're specifically written at a specific time and a moment in time, you can kind of see what political goings on is happening at that period and what that might have led you to think in different ways, potentially.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true, because right at the end of the process, we had the general election, which obviously recast the sort of discussion about constitutional reform, because other things being equal, you might think the Labour Party more open to it than the previous Conservative government. But it's also a remarkable election, which has profound implications for our constitutional future, in that a government was elected with nigh on two-thirds majority in Parliament on barely a third of the vote. And These things then give further stimulus to looking at the sort of constitutional issues around devolution, federalism and confederalism that we were keen to discuss.
Yeah, and what were the key things you really wanted? You know, what is the nub of the conversation that you wanted to get across for those who haven't read, had the chance to read the letters yet?
I mean, the UK can be described at the very least as a unitary state with three special status national territories possessing their own devolved institutions. But a few observers have optimistically, in my view, described these arrangements as a multinational state or a voluntary union. However, you know, such descriptions are premature as they imply the existence of a federally minded settlement with clear attribution of sovereignty across the whole, rather than that assigned solely at Westminster. So there's little escaping the fact in this context or that context that England, with 85% of the population, is more loudly represented there. So this is why our territorial constitution exists in some state of flux. The debate in Scotland around independence continues. The Commission on the Constitutional Future of Wales recommended fundamental reform of isle-wide structures. Northern Ireland's political settlement is still quite fragile, and discontent with how the present union functions has become a matter of increasing concern for many policymakers. And also, there's the general unease about how the piecemeal approach that successive governments have taken to introducing devolution across these isles have evolved. It's been progressed, as we know, on a nation-by-nation basis, and now in England, region by region, rather than collectively looking at the overarching architecture. And this is what David and I feel in our letters. Though we propose different models, we look at the overarching architecture. How can we find a solution that works for the whole, recognizing that we must embrace diversity within unity, at the same time as balancing any changes with continuity?
Yeah, I mean, my motivation was fairly direct and simple, and that's because I'm a unionist. I want to see the union preserved, and I believe a federal outcome is probably the only way that the union will be preserved in the future. And I feel the current union and its arrangements are in great peril. I think we are rather like we were in terms of our membership of the European Union after the Maastricht Treaty and that 20, 25-year period when people were umming and ahhing how much should we be in the EU. The anti-EU movement was growing and growing, and we're in a state of flux. But those that really believed in the EU, and for me, someone who now really believes in the union, they were failing to bring forward a scheme that would say, here's the union, this is why it works, this is what we need to do to make it survive in the future. And as well as using federal mechanisms, and where I differ completely from Glyndŵr, is that I think we need to look at the concept of sovereignty and accept that the UK state has sovereignty, and then there is an element of sub-state sovereignty in Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland, and potentially in the future in regions of England. And that's the classic federal approach, I think, that, you know, I take, that we should now formally divide sovereignty, which in many ways has already been divided in terms of what the position is in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, but that we should make this a well-designed formal declaration in a new Act of Union, for instance. So that's where I'm at and what I believe is, you know, required for the UK.
And what would, you know, I think reading the letters, you can see you're both aligned on what some of the problems are with the constitutional settlement as it is. In a kind of short sentence, you know, could you describe what are the key kind of crux points that display that the constitutional settlement as it is currently laid out is failing? You know, how would you, are there particular, you know, parts of that settlement that evidence it more, that failure more strongly than others, perhaps, Glyndŵr?
Well, you know, the institutional policy and cultural reforms necessary to establish a more consensual isle-wide governance structure need to be seriously examined. Decades-long shifts in public opinion and national party political dynamics in Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland and England, are leading to divergent views about their constitutional future, a situation only exacerbated by Brexit. But I do say, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, because looking at the present union, we must acknowledge that we have a set of common values, including belief in democracy, equality, personal liberty, and the rule of law, which are shared by unionists and non-unionists alike. Our economic union secures us a leading role in international organizations like the G7, WTO, IMF, and the OECD. And our social union supports spending on a basic level of common welfare, which helps redistribute some wealth based on need. So we must look firstly at what works well, acknowledge what works well, and then understand. And this is where I do differ from David. I believe sovereignty should be attributed to the nations, where individuals relate directly to their closest parliament, and that parliament in turn then delegates some of its sovereign authority to a central mechanism. That's a description of confederalism, but one which understands there's a need for common shared functions at the centre, which everyone signs up to with good faith and commitment.
And on the you mentioned earlier that the letters cover the general election period in the tail end of the letters. Constitutional change, there was some stuff in the now UK Labour government's manifesto that spoke to some elements of constitutional change, mainly when it comes to reformation of the House of Lords, for example. We're just coming up into the longer campaign of a Senate election. To what extent do you feel that constitutional change and reform is still on the political agenda? If you don't feel it is, how do we make it so that this is a lively conversation where people are able to put forward different ideas on constitutional reform that feel like they really matter to people's everyday lives? And how can you prepare the ground for a more constructive conversation on Wales and the UK's constitutional future? David, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, it is a challenge because people turn off constitutional matters until they're really on top of you, and it's really too late then to do the more design work to ensure you get a good decision-making process. This is what happened in the EU referendum, I think. It's what happened in the Scottish referendum in many ways. It was a very insular referendum, didn't really discuss other parts of the UK and how their governance would be affected if Scotland suddenly became independent. How on earth would Wales survive in a sort of elephant and mouse union that remained? So it was a very, very messy process. And I really do think that if you want to have a really robust state, you should be looking at some of these questions in good normal time, and then setting up processes that can sort of fully discuss them, so that as citizens we all know what the real options are. At the moment, the failure to reform the House of Lords is a red light, I think, warning us that our political leaders at the UK level are just not giving this matter enough attention. They're complacent and they just assume that you can muddle on. Well, that will not get you through a crisis. As I say to my unionist friends, in the last week of the independence referendum in Scotland, when there was an opinion poll on the final Sunday of the campaign that seemed to indicate that independence would be approved, and then the unionist leaders all raced up to Scotland and said, oh no, if you vote against independence, you won't be just backing the status quo, we will give you better devolution and the union will be infused with new energy. Well, that didn't really happen afterwards. There was a bit of fiddling around the edges, but I don't think that sort of approach will work again in what will definitely happen in the next 10 years or so, and that's the second referendum on Scottish independence. Unionists are going to have to be ready with what a new union is going to look like. And if we can't be bothered to reform the House of Lords, there's not much hope for us. We're supposed to be at heart a parliamentary union. That was what was the great advantage of the Acts of Union for Wales. It gave us representation in Westminster. Then Westminster and the Scottish Parliament merged into a new parliamentary union in 1707, Parliament at its heart. Now we have a Chamber of Parliament that is desperately in search of an effective function, and we're just allowing it to be a wasted asset. And I just think that's very, very sad. And it is, I'm afraid, a wider metaphor for the inertia that many so-called unionists have. I mean, they're asleep on the job, and they may be dreaming about the union, but they're not doing much to practically ensure it survives.
Gundua, how would you respond?
Yeah, no, we really do need to bring the whole constitutional conversation to the fore. Lots of good work was done before the election, but thereafterwards, there's been silence, you know, and, you know, we can, you know, and in promoting or framing a conversation, there are some overarching principles that can help inform our developing debate towards a better model of governance, maybe. You know, the first, as I've already said, is solidarity as an expression of our unity. You know, this principle should guide the activities of decision makers across all nations in a broader fashion, particularly in dealings over shared or concurrent powers. The second is subsidiarity as an expression of our diversity. You know, there are powerful, powerful arguments of giving people control, particularly over their domestic affairs, and thereby also the responsibility for raising money to pay for them, is perfectly a legitimate discipline to apply. And the third is, well, it's obvious, clarity. It is key that the public understand exactly at which tier of government power lies if the democratic process is to work effectively. However, you know, I strongly believe, and I think David's probably of the same view, that the answer to our predicament is wider than that, narrowly defined by the separate constitutional debates ongoing within the four nations of these isles today. In truth, you know, we have a responsibility not only to others within our own constituent parts, whether national or regional, but also a whole. So let us not forget, consent is the foundation of trust in any political system, and by balancing, and I'll use these words once more, the principles of change with continuity, diversity within a unified structure of sorts, we may arrive at some consensus, some success in our deliberations.
And I want to come back to England and then Wales, maybe, if I can. In terms of England, you've both spoken about how England's, you know, governance structure would play a central part in any constitutional reforms. You know, what are some of the challenges here? Because it doesn't appear that UK government are, or, you know, political parties are particularly interested in that. Does further devolution to city regions that we've seen over the last couple of years, are they a step in this direction of presenting different options of devolution to different parts of England? And maybe that counterbalances some of the asymmetrical nature of the UK. As you said before, England represents 85% of the population. If you can kind of devolve power down to city regions that are closer in number to the populations of Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales, then that might, you know, make for, you know, a different view. And also what your thoughts are on those recent changes, such as the Council of Nations and Regions, you know, is that significant or not in your view? Start with David, if that's okay.
Well, I think the English question is important, but let's remember, whatever we do, independence, confederalism, federalism, super devolution, which the Welsh Commission on the Constitution seemed to favour, whatever you do, England will still be there. And it's going to be a challenge in any political arrangement because it's a lot bigger than the other national units. And, you know, even the Republic of Ireland, then called the Irish Free State in the 1920s, had to contend with the fact that England or Britain was still a huge influence on their political life and economic life. And factors like that have to be remembered. But I think ultimately the domestic institutions for England are a matter for the English people. So we cannot say to them, well, you need to do X, Y, Z, because we in Scotland and Wales have decided to do A, B, C. So if the English want some form of regional devolution, then, of course, they should go ahead and construct it. They may want to do something that's like a super municipal government with the new city regions. They may want to do a bit of both. They may not want to do anything and just rely on some form of English legislative procedure established by convention within Westminster. We did experiment in this and under David Cameron's leadership, but that's a matter for the English. Whatever they choose to do will have an impact on us, and we need to cope with it. So our arrangements have to be robust enough. The UK's arrangements have to be robust enough to deal with what the people of England decide to do. And that point is very important, because should England decide they want to have their own parliament and their own government responsible to that parliament, that would be a big challenge, I think, to any future union. But it would not be something that would threaten Wales or Scotland directly. It would be something that would, I think, challenge the UK government as a whole, because you'd have an English government under it that was potentially as powerful as it was. And, you know, similar thing happened at the last days of the Soviet Union with the Russian Federation's power compared to the overarching state. So these things definitely need considering, but there does seem to be time. The English are not rushing this, and I think that we can be theirs friendly voices to encourage them to go further. But so far, I think the mayors have emerged as a very interesting development, which has considerable potential to go further, and that would be my tip as to what is likely to happen.
Bindua?
Yeah. Yes, an all-encompassing package of devolution for England would beneficially ensure that decentralised bodies become focal to island-wide affairs. You know, the fundamental architectural issue of our time is that the administrations in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland cover merely 15% of these isles' inhabitants. Consequently, intergovernmental relations across the UK have become marginal to the affairs of Westminster. A new constitutional design must place weight on the structural relationship between the devolved governments and the government in London in its dual capacity as that for the whole UK, for making English laws. And I would say once far-reaching devolution is introduced across England, what is, much of the work of the English government will be taken away possibly from London and sit under local or regional direction, leaving Westminster to focus on its strategic isle-wide functions. And complementarily, the House of Lords, as in Gordon Brown's commission, should purposely represent the various regions within all four UK territories in its composition. But alongside key for me, is that the existing Joint Ministerial Committee for intergovernmental relations continue as a forum of nations, so as not to confuse the concerns of regional devolution within England and its relationship with Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. In that kind of framework, where the concerns of each of the territories is understood uniquely within a context where the various territorial regions in each nation is dealt with in a sensitive way, would allow us to define a way of governance which puts us on a better footing for the future.
And coming back to the constitutional conversation in Wales, then you both mentioned the Independent Commission on the Constitutional Future of Wales, and their work is a subject that you bring up in your letters. We've gone a year on from the publishing of the final report of that commission, and as you know, federalism was one of the options for Wales's constitutional future forward, one of three, being federalism, entrenched devolution and independence. And David, you mentioned the letters as well, that entrenched devolution option also seems to look quite similar to federalism. How do you reflect on the Commission's work and where it sits a year on? Has it pushed on this constitutional conversation in Wales more, or was that, you know, at a moment where we were discussing these issues a bit more publicly than we do a year later on? And will it feed into the platforms of the political parties going into elections in like 8 months' time?
Yeah, I do commend their work. I think it's of great value, and it's a good platform for considering the options. You know, I do have some criticism of it, but that's, you know, because I am firmly a federalist. My criticism is that I don't think they recognised how that the current United Kingdom is not short of federalism, with devolution and allowing Scotland to have sovereignty over the independence issue. We've gone way beyond federalism. And the question is whether we would want to regulate some of these constitutional matters by perhaps coming back to a more considered, well-designed form of federalism. That would allow, for instance, if we do have another independence vote, how that would be negotiated. That's the direction they went in Canada after two highly divisive referendums on Quebec's independence. And I don't think they really tested that out. They didn't dismiss federalism, in fairness, but I think it's fairly cursory what they did. They just assumed that devolution really is a different model to federalism. And I think that it isn't really. It's a volatile version, you know, without the aspects of the rule book that you get in a more thought out federal decentralized constitution. However, the report is a good, clear report. There's lots of interesting evidence, and they engaged well with the public, and that's something now that the political parties should do for the future. So you know, they out of 5 stars, they get 4.5, I think, for their work genuinely.
What do you think, Lindua?
I agree with much of what David says. The current setup is close to federalism, but without the application of sovereignty that you'd or the written constitution underpinning the arrangements we have in place. I would criticise the fact that it didn't explore confederalism in any way, or certainly understanding the need to better link our national parliaments more directly to the inhabitants of each territory, and in doing so you're looking at models of popular sovereignty and other interesting things then on how you work collectively through central functions. Sovereignty as a concept may have been connected with the development of the modern state, but no state is today sovereign in the traditional sense. International law penetrates borders with global bodies such as the UN, World Trade Organization, IMF, and NATO are formed upon partnership arrangements between states. These are established ways of working which are clearly understood. Some of these supranational institutions are formed to tackle cross-border issues of common interest. You're delegating or transferring some sovereign authority in the process. And in turn, these bodies exercise their clearly defined responsibilities with binding effect on the states who sign up to them. So, there was an opportunity to look more creatively at and not just the history of these Isles, but also how the national parliaments have developed and evolved since the introduction of devolution, and how the aspirations of the peoples and the politicians in those settings could be better served through an arrangement that recognises the potential for sovereignty of these ancient nations, and also then the need to stand back and come to some formal understanding of what needs to be shared at the centre, the economy, the security, defence, currency. The conversation could have been a more nuanced conversation, but I applaud the work. The conversation is a positive conversation, I wasn't particularly happy that it didn't discuss at least a close form of confederal federalism.
Yeah, and I'm glad you spoke about global challenges as well, because the letters do go into some of those global challenges where, you know, sovereignty has to be pooled and that nation states themselves are ill-equipped to tackle, like whether that's, you know, climate as one, but also the rise of technology that transcends borders and necessarily nation states regulation. So I think that's really interesting. And as a kind of closer, I would also urge people to look at the booklet and look at the letters, because we're not able to get into all of the depths that you managed to get in each of your letters back and forth to one another. And they'll be published with this podcast. Is there anything further you'd like to touch on that you don't think we've had the chance to talk about?
Well, shall I start? I think it's very tempting to assume that Britain will continue to survive because it's been there for so long. And we should remember that the current state was established in 1707, which makes it, is it 69 years older than the United States? And things change. We live in a world of great political turmoil. We've been talking about international organizations. Well, you know, multinationalism is not in great shape at the moment, and we seem to be entering a world of, you know, one or two or three or four large powers fighting for their spheres of influence. And that, I think, will probably turn people eventually back to the idea of cooperation, because they'll see the disadvantages of the balance of power model. But given what's happening internationally, and the incredible changes we've had in the last 30 years, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union to the end of the Cold War, Britain's withdrawal from the EU, this should remind us that big constitutional stuff does happen. Now, it may be a long fuse, but when the bang goes, it's a big bang, and that people need to be aware of that. And it's too late when you hear the explosion to say, oh, but I wanted Britain to continue as long as it reformed in certain ways. You need to get ahead and do the reform now. And if unionists don't do that, then I think the future is bleak.
Yeah, it's my view that some sort of federally inspired reconstitution of these isles that balances, on the one hand, the contrasting aspirations of unionism and its centralizing forces, and on the other, national ambitions for cementing sovereignty, is a model of territorial governance which is likely to succeed in the long term. You know, we may as well accept that a measure of friction is and will always be a feature of our isle-wide interactions and relationships at both political and governmental levels. And to mitigate this demands greater maturity in approach on the part of our parliamentarians and institutional arrangements robust enough to formally understand, manage and consider different priorities. Through firstly embracing variations in territorial contexts, and secondly, promoting our shared values and visions, we can confidently advance the legitimate expectations of citizens' rights and political representation across all of these isles, including those of England and its regions. David mentioned devolution. You know, since its introduction, national attitudes across the UK have evolved substantially. Westminster must better understand these shifts in identity and political stances, and strive for a constitutional compromise, one of strategic significance that will address the challenges and aspirations of all people, nations and regions across these islands, and will renew, if not replace, our piecemeal system of territorial governance. You know, it's evolved bit by bit over time, and we need to move towards one that is more coherent, stable and fit for purpose for the 21st century.
Excellent. Thank you. Fascinating to talk to you, as it was when I spoke to you a couple of years back now on some of these issues. And it's good to keep in touch to see what you've how your thinking has evolved as events have evolved. So thanks both for your time. As I said before, We urge you to look at the booklet and the letters, which are included in the link. If you've enjoyed this podcast, then please rate and share. You can keep up with all of the IWA's work on our social media channels and on our website. There's lots of great in-depth articles on Wales's constitutional future, not least from Glyndwr himself, but also from Mick Antoniv recently also. And if you're not a member, please look at our work and become a member to support all of our work. But thank you, David. Thank you, Glyndwr. Thanks for being with me.
Pleasure.
Thank you.